Welcome to another PI World podcast. This is an audio-only version offered as another way to enjoy our great content. A full video version can be seen on piworld.co.uk, where you can find many more videos of interest to investors.
I'm here today with Bill Faulkner-Corbett, who's head of Signet, and Signet stands for Serious Investor Groups Network. It's part of ShareSoc and a tremendous network of private investor groups who meet regionally throughout the UK, both remotely and in person, to discuss share ideas, investing strategy, and their knowledge with like-minded people. And of course, there's the social element to it as well. Bill wanted to spread the word of Signet, and he's presented this excellent presentation to his London Signet group. And it's on the power of compounders and, key to that, how to value them. And this demonstrates the quality and the sort of insight that you'll get from your local group. At the end, we've got more details on how to join Signet. Bill, thank you so much for recording this. Can you tell us a bit about your background and how you came to be part of Signet?
Yeah. Well, firstly, it's a pleasure, and thank you very much for doing this with us. I've been investing for just over 50 years, I suppose, but initially, like many people, it was unit trusts, then investment trusts, ETFs, so collectives. And I really started investing in individual shares at the end of 2008. And my prompt for doing that, one of the investment trusts I had a holding in, I was reading their annual report, and it said words to the effect, I can't remember the exact numbers, but, you know, we're very sorry, but the net asset value of your investment trust has dropped by about 45% this year. But the good news is that the market dropped 50%. So we have overperformed the market by 5%. Oh, and by the way, this entitles us to a performance fee of many, many millions of pounds. And I think I got a bit annoyed by that. And that's when I started investing in individual shares.
Tremendous, tremendous. And can you tell us a little bit about the power of compounding, which is what your presentation's on, and how you arrived at this process?
Yes, I think my process has developed over time. And so I started off very much as a value investor. And that was early 2009. I mean, the bottom of the market was March 2009. So I was enthusiastically buying cheap shares then. But then after a few years of that, and that worked very well, after a few years of that, I began to read more, think more, and discover that there was more to investing than just buying cheap stuff. And of course, a lot of the cheap stuff had gone away. The valuations had gone up by then. So I felt I needed to look for something different, something more. And that's when I came across this concept of a compounder. I suppose initially reading about the famous Warren Buffett and Charlie Munger, you know, many investors' heroes. And so I think, you know, Charlie Munger in that quote sums it up to a certain extent, that you're looking for something that isn't too big, it's got room for growth, but its return on capital is high. And importantly, it has both the marketplace and the capability to keep that high return on capital and grow with it, retain its earnings, invest them wisely, and just keep on growing. So that's what I'm looking for.
And you say here that if you invest in a company that grows by 18% a year, you could end up with an eight bagger over 12 years. But doesn't that very much depend on what you pay for it to begin with?
I think the answer is yes and no. I mean, what I've put there is just a sort of illustration of doubling sales, doubling margins, doubling PE. So you know, in that ideal case, you've bought something at a very reasonable price. As it grows, as the market recognizes the strength of the company, the PE will go up. So ideally, yes. However, there are many different ways to get to that number 8. You know, one example, sales could actually go up 4 times, margins could double, the PE could stay the same, and you're still getting the same result. Sales could go up 5 times, margin doubles, and PE goes down by 20%, and you're still getting it. And I think that's what Charlie Munger is saying in his quote, that yes, valuation is important, but don't obsess about it, because even if you do pay a bit too much, if you get the right compounding company, you will still get a very good result. And, you know, one of the proponents of compounding is Terry Smith, the Fund Smith guru, who clearly has done very well. And interestingly, in his book, Investing for Growth, he identifies 20 examples of buying businesses with PEs of over 30. And over quite a long period, all of those high-priced businesses have beat the market. The one with the biggest PE was L'Oreal, which he identifies had a PE of 281 and still beats the market.
Amazing. So you've got a method that brings together the different criteria that you look at. Can we go through that? Because it starts, looking at this, it starts to give confidence to pay perhaps a higher PE, say, for a stock, because you're looking at other characteristics that mean you're identifying which these compounders are.
Yes. I mean, the starting point is introducing these two concepts of market value and intrinsic value. So intrinsic value is something you can try to calculate by analysing the numbers, but also not just the numbers, the marketplace, the competitive advantage of the company. Market value is what the market has on its notice board every day. And much of the time, these two are the same. But the efficient market hypothesis tells us they're the same all the time. I mean, I just don't believe in that. I think that's, I mean, some, you know, I liken it to believing in Father Christmas. And I don't think many investors do. It's starting with that idea that there are these two different values. And what we need to do is to be able to work out the intrinsic value. And then we can compare it with the market value and see, is it correctly valued? Is it overvalued? Is it undervalued?
So how do you go about your evaluating as to what you're happy to pay for a share for these compounders?
Well, I mean, what I've tried to do, I've got 3 methods in this presentation, and method 1 is really where I started. Jim Slater, The Zulu Principle, again, a very well-known book with individual investors. And he came up, no, I don't think he invented this PEG ratio, but he promoted it. And I think he made it a fairly commonly used tool. And so he's recommending buying companies on a PEG of less than 1, depending a bit on the size as to how much less than 1. And that's very much how I started, looking for low PEG ratios.
And this is really pulling in the power of growth. So it's looking at the PE and the growth to give you a PEG ratio, and you want something less than 1.
Yes. Yeah.
So then you've got the PEG. How do you take it forward from there?
Well, then a lot of my selection is screening. Initially, when I started, I was just using the Financial Times has quite a good free screening tool. And so that's what I was using initially. As I moved on, Stockopedia was coming on the scene. And so I subscribed to that and used their screening tool there.
And what are your screening criteria?
Oh, they vary a lot. I mean, now the three main components of a compounder, so return on capital, growth, and valuation.
And you're talking earnings growth rather than revenue growth or both?
Yes. I mean, typically earnings per share growth.
Perfect. Okay. So carry us on. Once you've screened for these companies and you've looked at the PEG ratio, what are you looking at next?
Well, so I use the PEG ratio much less now than I used to. I mean, this is something Microsoft I sold in 2016 based on using the PEG ratio, based on Slater's rule of anything over P of 20 is probably overvalued. At that stage, it had historical negative growth. It had been growing, I think, it's about minus 3% CAGR of the past 5 years. So based on all of that, I sold it. And in retrospect, that was a terrific mistake. So I think that was really one of the prompts. It took a few years to work that out. But yeah, that was one of the prompts that I needed to look for other ways of doing things.
And so what did that take you on to?
Well, initially, it took me on to accepting higher PE ratios, but without any basis of what the right number was. And I was, some of those were very successful, but I just felt there was an awful lot of guesswork and intuition, not much of a scientific basis to guessing whether something was correctly valued, overvalued, undervalued. And so for 5, 6, 7 years, I was really guessing. I was in the dark.
So have you streamlined the process so you're not guessing anymore?
Well, I read a book called Benjamin Graham and the Power of Growth Stocks by Frederick Martin. So I think I read that 18 months ago, perhaps. And he introduced this formula of 8.5 plus 2x growth. So I started using that.
And that gives a more heady PE of say, 28.5 in your example here.
Yes.
So you're happy to pay those sort of PEs?
I mean, as ever, if I can get it for cheaper, I prefer it. But yes, I would pay that. Yes, yeah. For the right company.
So let's explore that one a little bit more. I think you talk about a margin of safety and internal rate of return, which might give you more confidence in the strategy that you're purporting.
Yes. So again, it was Graham that introduced this concept of the margin of safety. And again, this is from Martin's book. It turns out that for growth stock, he used something else. He uses the internal rate of return. I mean, I was very pleased to read this because this is something I've been using myself for about 5 years, something like that. And so the internal rate of return is essentially you just take the cash flows. And so the first main cash flow is when you buy a share. As you're holding it, you might, if it's paying dividends, you might get some dividend income, which is positive, cash flow in. And then at some period, if you ever sell the share, that's the second big cash flow when you get the proceeds of selling it. And the IRR is the discount rate at which the inflows and the outflows are equal, essentially.
Tremendous. And so how does that help you in deciding what you're going to buy?
I mean, I set a what's called a hurdle rate. So I'm looking for an IRR of 15%. The theory being, if everything in my portfolio is given 15%, my portfolio will give me 15%, and I think that's a very desirable number.
Absolutely, I think we'd all take that.
Yes, I mean, what I'm now doing is just coming up with a few scenarios. You know, what if the exit, playing around with the exit PE, what if I invested and it goes up to what I think the fair value is? Another scenario, if it stays at the same PE. So yes, I do a few scenarios and see what the IRR comes out at.
And that's what these examples are.
Yes, I've got two examples there which show that. So yes, the first one is a company with EPS as shown. I'm paying 24.7 purchase price, and I'm assuming that I exit at the same multiple. And there's the second example using a different exit PE. So there I've used the PE calculated by the Graham formula, which is higher, and that's an even more attractive IRR, 29%.
So with growth stocks of the sort that you're considering, is all growth beneficial? Do you have growth at any cost?
So that's a very good question. And my answer to that is no, it's not. And that's, for me, is the disadvantage of, firstly, the PEG ratio, and secondly, the Graham formula, because they assume, if you took them literally, they assume that all growth is beneficial.
And so can you expand on that, what we should be looking for, what growth is beneficial and what we want to be avoiding?
The two key numbers in deciding whether it's beneficial are, firstly, the return on capital that the company is generating, and secondly, the cost of that capital. And the analogy I use here is you find a savings account that's paying 5%. You think that's a great rate, but I haven't got any cash to put in at the moment, so I'll borrow some. You only find you can borrow at 6%. Would you take the loan for 6% to go into a savings account paying 5%? And I think the answer is obvious. And that's, for me, it's the same for a company. Would it raise capital at 6% if it only gives a return of 5%?
Absolutely. And very pertinent at the moment when the cost of capital has increased so much.
Yes. Yes. I mean, I think the cost of capital, it's a bit of a nebulous figure. It's hard to pin down exactly what it is, but I mean, for definite, there's some things on that points on that slide it depends on, and one of them is the risk-free rate, determined by the rate of government bonds. And as you say, I mean, that has gone up significantly, and that's part of what's driven valuations down. But typically, I mean, I think it's between about 6 and 15%. So a large US company with little debt in a good industry might be 8%, but a small UK company could be 15%. I find you just have to guess for that. There's no accurate way that I know of getting the cost of capital.
But you're effectively looking for companies that use their capital very efficiently so that they are generating profit from any capital that they put to work.
Yes. Yeah. So their return on capital is higher than their cost of capital.
Yes. And what do you target for return on capital employed?
For a FTSE 250 company, maybe 15%. For a smaller company, 20%.
And have you increased those figures as the cost of debt has started to rise?
No.
Is that something that investors should consider?
I think it is, yes. Yeah, yes. I think in today's environment, you should probably be looking for a bit more than you were before. Yeah.
And your method really comes together with an example from Credit Suisse, which sort of, to me, pulls it all together and actually gives you confidence to pay, in my view, eye-watering PEs for some companies. So do you want to go on to the method three within your criteria of selection?
Yes. I mean, having read the book by Martin, that was a step forward. But I was still very conscious that there was nothing in that formula about return on capital. And that's, you know, that for me was important. So I set about digging, doing a bit of research on the internet mainly. And I came up with this paper by a guy called Michael Mubisin, who is quite well known, I think. He's written several books, quite good books. And what he has essentially done is just put together a whole series of models using various different returns on capital, costs of capital and growth. And from those, he published some data on what the appropriate PE is, which I find fascinating.
Yeah, well, so did I. And this table here is the nub of it, I think, with different PE multiples against different growth rates and return on capital employed.
So that is the table taken from his paper, which gives 20 or so numbers. But then the line underneath is quite important. He then goes on to a really high return on capital and really high growth, and this number of the PE of 70. So that's the data you can find from his paper. What I then did is I extrapolated to create a bigger table that went up to that 25%, 50% point. So that's my table based on 12% cost of capital. I mean, what I have a spreadsheet where I can put in the return on capital and the cost of capital, and then it just changes the numbers along the top line.
But it does give you confidence to pay really quite high PEs that a lot of investors would absolutely balk at.
Yes, yeah.
What's the highest PE that you have paid for a company? Or I think you might indeed be coming on to some examples.
I can't remember. I think, what I say is I wouldn't want to pay over 30. Maybe I've paid 35. I can't quite remember. Yeah.
Okay. So if we go back to the Microsoft example that you sold out of regretfully in hindsight, how would this method have helped you to make the right decision with Microsoft?
Well, so, using the Credit Suisse method, I would have come up, I think, with a PE of just below 40, using the Graham method, 38.5. I should say what I'm finding, I'm keeping track of the Graham method as I use the Credit Suisse method. They come up with fairly similar figures. So, any investor who's a bit daunted by those tables and or doesn't have the time to do that sort of thing, I'm finding the Graham method is a very good approximation. So they'd end up with those large numbers, which would have been well above the market value at the time. I would have held on.
So give us a couple of examples that stocks that you've picked by this method.
I've given this presentation or similar presentation to two London groups. One was my own group, the Central London Group, in June last year. And one of the members had bought that month Synopsis. So I looked at that and my conclusion is I wouldn't buy it and I didn't buy it. But even so, I mean, it's made a fair return since then. But then the second one to the Leicester Square Group in September, I presented Supermicro, SMCI, which is something I had just bought. And that has done incredibly well. I don't think I can give full credit. I think luck comes into this as well. And I think I've just got lucky on this one. But yeah, the method worked in spades for that particular one.
Superb. And did that come up from your screening? Or...
Yes. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, that was a superb one. Fascinating presentation and methodology. So how is the current Bill Investing performance comparing to before you were using this methodology?
I mean, that's very hard to say. My shift to compounders really started 5, 6, 7 years ago. And I've had some good years. And I've had some not so good years. I think the difficulty is I'm comparing that with 2009, 2010, which, you know, were excellent years. But the market was different. The circumstances were different. I think in general, I mean, all the ones I bought as compounders have done well. I think my trouble has been that what pulls my performance down is over those years, I haven't been using this as my only method. I've also been looking at value. I've kept trying to do some of that. I read the Graham book, as I said, about 18 months ago. Took a bit of time to implement that. The Credit Suisse document, I don't think I found until about a year ago. So I think it's still quite early days, but certainly, I mean, the SMCI example gives me great hope that this is going to work well.
Well, you'll have to come back and report to us in a few years' time to tell us how it's, you can show us performance stats from before and the performance stats following and see where it takes us to. But it's a fascinating presentation. So thank you very much and some useful bits in that, which I shall certainly bear in mind in my own investing. So for people that might be interested in joining a Signet group near them, can you tell us how they can go about that and what they can expect?
Well, answering the second question first, the essence of Signet is the groups. Most of them meet face-to-face. Some of them still meet online. I think you can expect a group of like-minded people. I think you can expect to hear ideas that you wouldn't otherwise hear. I think you can expect people to be critical of what you're doing. And I think that's always a good thing. I think that's something that can only improve your performance. And I think you will find a social environment, which is enjoyable. That's certainly what we hope.
And they're quite small groups, aren't they? They're about 10 to 15 people.
Yes. I mean, some are even smaller.
Okay.
There are a couple with maybe 5 people. And it's sustainable even with 5.
And they meet what, monthly?
Yes, I mean, it varies a bit group by group, but monthly is the typical period. Some meet every 2 weeks, some perhaps every 6 weeks.
And it tends to be a bit of a remote meeting and face-to-face meeting, so a bit of mix and match.
Yes. I mean, some groups do both.
Great. So if Someone wants to become a member or find the nearest group to them, how do they go about it and how much does it cost them?
You can email info@sharesoc.org and say you're interested. There's a link to the website. There's a joining page on the website. The subscription for a signet-only member is £50 a year. But as we've mentioned, we are part of ShareSoc. And so you can get a combined membership of ShareSoc plus Signet, and you get a bit of a discount doing it that way. We have a 3-month trial period, so what we call a no quibble guarantee. So if within the 3 months you decide it's not for you, you get your money back.
Tremendous. Well, you can't say fairer than that.
The other thing to mention, I mean, we have groups, you know, more or less all over the country, but there are some places that are quite a distance from a group. So if you are an experienced investor and you're interested, but you can't find a group near you, we'd be very interested to hear from you nevertheless, that, you know, maybe you want to start your own group. So at the moment, we're opening a new group about once every month.
Wow. And you've got a big database of investors throughout the country. So you then email people in the area in which a person might want to start a group. Is that right?
Yes. So, I mean, and this was a great benefit of joining ShareSoc. They have a much bigger database than we have. They have both paying members and associate members. And so when we come to setting up a new group, we email all the Signet members, but also all the ShareSoc members, who are much, much greater in number. And that's how we put new groups together. And it's working well.
Tremendous. Bill, thank you very, very much indeed for a tremendous walk through your investing process and also a little bit of an introduction to Signet. Really, really appreciate it.
It's a pleasure. Thank you very much, Tamsin.
PI World videos and podcasts are for general information and interest. They do not constitute any kind of recommendation or inducement to buy shares of any company. PI World is not offering any kind of financial advice, and nothing in our material should be taken as such.